now added at the beginning of each day's notes for the next several classes in red, recorder on. So with luck, that'll work. All right, as usual, let me start by seeing what questions you have from Monday's class and the readings for Monday's class, and then go on to any questions you have from the readings for today. So can we start with the first? Anybody have things they want to talk about what we did Monday? Yes, no, maybe, no. All right. Anybody have things from today's reading, which was the beginning of contracts, that they'd like to talk about? This, yep.
When they talk about simple descriptions, they don't seem to talk much about transaction costs. And so my assumption is when you start talking about that, it drastically changes the outcome.
There certainly are places where you can say useful things about transaction costs. To take one example, which is really related to the game theory, if you have a bilateral monopoly bargain with a really big bargaining range, that's likely to result in expensive transaction costs because it's worth it to both parties to spend a lot of time and effort haggling over trying to move the line in their direction. Does that make sense? So one of the sort of standard law and econ examples is, suppose that our rules say that if my factory is making too much noise and that the people near it have some kind of a legal claim to have you stop doing that. One possible rule would be that they have a property right, that is, they can get an injunction to shut down my factory unless I have their permission to make the noise. An alternative rule would be a liability right, that they can sue me for the costs imposed on them. One problem with the first, with the injunction, is that you might end up with a bilateral monopoly bargain with a very large bargaining range. Because if you imagine that I have no way of making the factory quiet, shutting down the factory will cost me $10 billion. I'm only doing the equivalent of $10,000 worth of cost to the neighbors through noise. So I would, if I have to, be willing to pay them up to $10 million for permission to keep making noise. They would, if they have to, be willing to accept anything more than $10,000. And it's worth both of us spending a lot of time and effort and money on lawyers trying to push the price in our direction. That's a case where you have some theory which tells you something useful about transaction costs. And that's an argument in that kind of situation for liability rules over property rules for damages rather than injunction. Similarly, and this is a point which really is mentioned in the book, but I don't put in terms of transaction costs, is the situation where we have got a fixed price contract, and then I, the buyer, want to change something. I discover, you could take the extreme case, I suppose, which would be where I discover that some regulatory agency has an absolute requirement because of the American Disabilities Act, the ADA, which hadn't even occurred to me, and that we have to change something in order to comply with. And now, what's the situation? The building's half built. It would be very costly for me to say to the contractor, all right, you're fired. I'll pay you whatever our terms were for my breach of contract and hire somebody else. But short of that, I've in effect got to pay whatever he asks. On the other hand, he might be willing to accept a fairly small amount if he had to, because it may not be very costly to make these changes. And therefore, we've set up a bilateral monopoly market with a big bargaining range, and again, there are serious risks of costs of bargaining range. So that would be an example, which is in the book, although I don't put it in transaction costs, where if you think there's a serious risk of that, you might want a cost-plus contract on the grounds that then you will be much freer to change the terms, to change what's being done, because after all, you're paying for it. Or you might want to include terms specifying what happens. I think one suggestion they raised, you have a fixed price contract with a cost plus term for modifications to the contract. So all of those are places where it seems to me the transaction costs do become relevant. Does that make sense? Other things that struck people that they wanted to talk about in this? All right, well, let me, as usual, go back a step just to do a very quick review, not of everything we did last time, but of the last bit of what we did last time, which was the insurance, where basically we're talking about one reason to get insurance and two reasons not to get insurance, and it's the balance among those that decides when you want insurance, but similarly the balance among those decides how you decide who should bear the risk. In contracts, for example, where part of what the contract is doing is allocating risk. Think about the question. Cost of building my building goes up. Do I, the buyer, pay that, or does the contractor have to swallow those costs? That's one difference between a cost plus and a fixed price contract. Right? The reason why you would want insurance, or the reason why you would want to shift risk to somebody else, is that you are risk averse, which really means that you have declining marginal utility income. That for some reason, losing a large sum, losing $100,000, is for you more than 100 times worse than losing $1,000, that's one way of putting it. And therefore, you're willing to pay $1,000 in order to avoid one chance in 100, or maybe a little bit less than one chance in 100 of losing $100,000. Does that make sense? So that's the reason why you would want insurance. Note that you want to distinguish shifting risk from shifting cost. That obviously I would always like to shift risk if that means that you'll insure me for free. All right. The distinction is that if I pay you, if I give up an uncertain cost and get in exchange a certain cost small enough so that the expected value is the same. Expected value is probability times amount. All right. So if you imagine some transaction by which I get rid of one chance in 100 of losing 100,000 in exchange for a certainty of losing 1,000. I haven't shifted the cost at all. The cost is the same on average both cases, but I've eliminated all of the risks. It's now completely certain rather than the uncertain. All right, does that distinction make sense? Because it's an important distinction, because it's tempting to say, well, of course, you always want to get rid of risk. But you don't always want to get rid of risk. It depends on the price or the cost for getting rid of risk. Right? It's like saying you always want to go to the doctor. Well, that may depend on how sick you are and how expensive the doctor is. speaking of which. Anyway, so the first problem, as I say, is the first issue is why you want insurance. And then the point to notice is that whether you want it for this reason depends largely on how large the sums at stake are relative to the assets. So if you think about, for a single individual, I don't want to insure against $100 losses. $100 is a small part of even my annual income, let alone my lifetime income, and the value to me of a dollar isn't going to change significantly over that. Yep.
You said the first part again, whether you want insurance.
Depends. The value to you of shifting the risk, shifting the loss would always be a good thing if somebody was kind enough to take the loss from you. But shifting the risk, keeping the average loss the same, how desirable that is depends on how large the sums are in question relative to your assets, typically. So if you think of a private individual, there isn't any good reason to insure against a lit, from this standpoint, from risk aversion, against a loss of 1% of your annual income, because the value of a dollar to you isn't going to change significantly. You might even argue it should be in terms of lifetime income, because you can shift money among years by borrowing and lending. That's not what you say. On the other hand, it makes a lot of sense to insure against a loss that's equal to a year's income, or 2 years' income, or 5 years' income, the kind of loss which really will make you sizably worse off. In the case of a firm, if you imagine a firm with 100 factories, each with an independent risk of burning down, the actual risk the firm has is very low, because average over 100 factories, it knows it's going to lose, you know, 0, 1, or 2 factories a year, roughly. So it's not a huge uncertainty, and therefore it's not willing to pay much to get rid of that risk. Now, one could argue that firms that are on the stock market ought never to be risk averse. And the argument here is that the real human beings to whom the money values are the stockholders, that for most stockholders, the stock in one firm is a small part of their assets, and therefore they, stockholders, would prefer the firm if you're willing to take any gamble where the expected return is positive, even if there's lots of risk. But it's a little unclear, because you might argue that the firm has got some value in terms of the expertise of its employees, the network of relationships it has, and so forth, and that there may be cases where losing enough so the firm goes broke really results in a larger loss than it seems, because it obsoletes all of those things. I don't want to go into that. My point is only that there are some reasons why some firms or some individuals may be more interested in shifting risk. Why don't you want to shift risk? And there are basically two major problems with shifting risk. And the first is moral hazard. And moral hazard means the fact that when you shift the risk, you are also shifting the incentive to prevent the risk from eventuating. And if you imagine a risk that's purely random, you have no control over, that's not a problem. If you think of most ordinary risks, such as the chance of being in an auto accident or having your factory burned down or even getting sick, which depends, you know, the deal on precautions you take, that the result of shifting that risk away from you is you have less incentive to take precautions to prevent it. And why is that a problem? It's not that you don't take all possible precautions. No rational person takes all possible precautions. It's that you don't take all of the precautions that are worth taking. Think in an expected value sense, if a $100 precaution on average saves you $200 of fire damage, then you want to take it. If a $100 precaution on average saves you $50 of fire damage, you shouldn't. You'll be $50 poorer for taking it. Make sense. And assuming you're rational, if you bear all the costs of the fire, it is in your private interest to take any precautions which pay for themselves in terms of reduced risk. If you have none of the risk of fire, on the other hand, there's no reason to take any costly precautions at all. And if you have half the risk of fire, because you've insured the factory for half its value, you will then want to take those precautions that cost no more than half their value. All right, that makes sense? Because you're only getting half the value, because half the savings from reduced cost of fire is going to the insurance company and half to you. Argument? Here? Yes? No? Okay, no. All right. And now you might say, well, why is this a problem for me? I mean, if I take less precautions, it means the insurance company is worse off. But that then gets back to the point that they're making at the beginning of this chapter, which is that if we have a choice, if something happens that makes us on net worse off, the insurance company is not in business for charity. They are going to know about the moral hazard problem, and they are therefore going to charge me a price which makes insurance a good deal for them, even though they know I'm only taking the really good precautions and not the moderately good precautions. Make sense so far? So therefore, it's going to cost me money. So the result is that allowing for the cost of failing to take some precautions worth taking, getting insured makes me, in expected value terms, worse off. Getting expected value on average. It may still be worth doing it because of risk aversion. But that in addition to the cost of the insurance company having to pay its rent and salaries, there's a further cost that it distorts my incentives in a way which results in a less than optimal level of precaution, and that's going to result in net cost, which I'm going to ultimately pay in my insurance premiums. All right? So that's the problem against it. But I pointed out that there may be some cases where that's actually a feature rather than a bug, and those are the cases where you're transferring the risk to someone who is more competent than you are to deal with it. So you could imagine the case where you insure your factory for 90 or 100% of its value, but you agree that you will take the insurance company's orders on what precautions to take. That they make those rules. They're more expert than you are in what precautions to take. It's now in their interest to take the right precautions because they're getting the benefit and paying for it. So let them buy the sprinkler system in the extreme case. That would then be a case where you might choose to get insured, not really because of risk aversion at all, but because you want, in effect, to make it in someone else's interest to do the right things for you. All right? And you might think in lots of contexts that really are analogous to that. If you think about hiring a salesman on a basis where he gets a percentage of his sales rather than a fixed income, one way of looking at it is you're shifting some of the risk from the employer to the employee. And why are you doing that? To give the employee a good incentive to do a really good job of selling your stuff. All right. So it's really an analogous case, very common kind of situation. And then the additional problem, which I don't remember the book discusses at all, but which I discussed last time towards the end, is what's called adverse selection. And that's the problem that if you have asymmetric information, if one party knows more about the risk than the other, for example, the person who wants to buy insurance probably knows more about how careful he is and how sick he is if it's health insurance or whatever than the insurance company does. The seller of the used car probably knows more about its quality, about its condition than the buyer. That in those cases, you have the problem that the willingness to buy or sell by the person with the extra information signals that information. And it means that you may choose not to sell something, even though it's worth more to the buyer than it is to you, because your offer to sell will be taken as evidence that it's low quality. That will result in the buyer offering you less than it's really worth for it, and that will result in it's not being worth selling. All right. Ditto for insurance the other direction. That means that you will have somebody who is a good risk and to whom insurance is worth a little bit more than it costs to produce it, but not very much, may not get insured because when he buys insurance, the insurance company will take that as evidence not that he's one of the best risks who wants to buy insurance, but that he's an average of the people who want to buy insurance. The average of the people who want to buy insurance are poor risks, or at least poorer than average risks. That's the worse risk you are, the more attractive insurance looks to you. And therefore, you will have people failing to get insured, even though it's worth insuring. All right? Argument made clear so far. So, I suppose you could take an extreme case, the one which is now a very hot issue, which is with the Obamacare proposals, the question of whether you can or can't decouple a rule saying that insurance companies have to sell insurance at the same price independent of pre-existing conditions from the requirement that you compel people to buy insurance. And the obvious problem is that that's a case where you are forcing adverse selection because you're not allowing, even if the insurance company has the information, you're not allowing them to use it. So therefore, in that case, if you don't force people to buy insurance, the sensible strategy for many people will be to go uninsured until they become very bad risks, which is what happens after your regular doctor's appointment that you've been paying for yourself turn up something that's going to be very expensive, then you buy the insurance. That's an obvious problem, and the solution in the existing legislation is to say, we aren't going to give you the option, you're going to have to buy insurance whether you like it or not. And one can view one view of various group insurance plans, such as employee insurance, is that they're a less coercive version of the same idea, namely, if all our employees are insured, the employee isn't getting to decide whether he's insured according to whether or not he's a bad risk. Therefore, the insurance company knows they've got a random mix of people, and therefore they can charge a lower price than if they had people who were on average poor risks shown by the family line. Somebody had a question? No? Sorry, someone has a question back there. Anyway, and I then raised this on something that was on the syllabus for you to think about, which is the genetic testing issue, which is really an issue that came up long before Obama was elected. I started thinking about it when I heard somebody give a talk at the University of Chicago at some public event or other where he was saying that, of course, insurance companies shouldn't be allowed to use genetic testing information because if they did, then people who have the bad luck that was none of their fault to have bad genes, so to speak, that genetic characteristics made them likely to have high medical costs or likely to die young would end up not having to pay a higher price or not be able to get insurance. And it struck me that there was a problem with what he was proposing, which is what this question was. So what's the problem? Suppose we say that suppose genetic testing exists, and suppose, as is perhaps becoming the case, that it's good enough so that for some people it gives sizable information about either their risk of dying in the case of life insurance or their risk of medical costs in the case of medical insurance. And so suppose we say, well, it's unfair that people who have bad luck, none of their fault, they have bad genes, should have to pay higher prices for life insurance or for medical insurance. So what we're going to say is that it's illegal for the insurance company to require as a condition of insurance or as a condition of a good price for insurance that you get genetic testing and they see the results. What's going to happen? Anybody? Are there any problems with that? Yeah.
You're creating an adverse selection where the customer or the person who wants to get insurance can go and get their genes tested.
That's right.
At that point, they know.
That's right. It's a straightforward adverse selection problem. How important it is will depend on how large the effects are. Obviously, if the genetic information leaves you a little bit of information, it doesn't much matter. But if it gives you a lot of information, then the sensible thing to do is you get tested. And if the genetic information says you have very serious risk, you buy lots of health insurance or life insurance if you've got survivors you're worried about. And the genetic information says, boy, you've won the genetic lottery. You've got a solid heart. You're very unlikely to ever get cancer. You know, you're going to make it to 95 at least, and probably 105. You then say, well, why should I throw my money away insuring against things that aren't going to happen to me? So that's the problem. And then the result will be, if you think about the person in the middle, as it were, the person who would like insurance at a reasonable price, the insurance company will say, wait a minute, we've got a range. If you think about how risky people are, you can think of it as sort of a bell curve like this, something like that, where you say these are the people who are really bad at risk, so these are the people who are never going to see a doctor in their life and never need to, a lot of people in between. And the insurance company is going to say, at the price we are charging, these people aren't going to buy insurance. So therefore, our guess, one, if you buy our insurance, is that you're somewhere around here, not in the middle of the distribution, because the what Dale's been cut off. Since you're there, we're going to have to charge a price, of course, when you're like that, that's going to push our price a little higher, and that's going to cut off a few more people, and how far it goes is going to depend on the numbers, but the result will be that there will be a bunch of people down here who would be happy, would like to get insured at a fair price, meaning a fair price given their characteristics, but won't choose to get insurance at a price which takes their buying the insurance as evidence they're probably bad risk. So that's the problem with that solution. Can you think of any possible way? Alternative. The alternative would be, the simple alternative, you have no rules about it. The insurance company is free to make its rates conditioned on your genetic testing. If that happens, notice that in the first version, what happens is that these people are uninsurable. They can't, in fact, get rid of their risk. These people are insured for what for these people is on average a fair price, though obviously some of them are overpaying and some of them underpaying. If we allow the genetic testing, what now happens is that everybody, simplest way of putting it is, the non-genetic risk is now insurable, but the genetic risk is now uninsurable. Does that make sense? For exactly the same reason that you can't get people to bet on the outcome of rolling a die after you've rolled it. Well, once everybody can do genetic testing, now the die roll before you were born that determined your genes has already been done, therefore it's not insurable. Consequently, at that point, people face an uninsurable risk at birth of having bad genes from a health standpoint and therefore having a higher cost of health insurance, but they have given that the all of the other risks that go into health costs are now insurable. All right? And that's the trade-off. Can you see how you could conceivably notice that part of what's interesting about this is that if what I described were the only effect of genetic testing, and it isn't, obviously. It also provides useful information what you should do, but suppose you ignore that. Then this would be a case where scientific progress made us worse off. Because without the testing, all of the risk associated with your health outcomes is insurable. And with the testing, only part of it is insurable. Since people are risk averse, that's a net loss. All right? Makes sense? Doesn't make sense? All right. Suppose you wanted to get back to the previous world, even though testing exists, what legal rules might you consider? Kiel?
Insuring prior to conception or prior to...
That one possibility would be if you could somehow have parents buy health insurance for their children before the children were conceived. That would be... Obviously, a lot of problems with that, but that's one very interesting idea that you do. You go back before the die is rolled. It's not perfect, of course, because the insurance company might want genetic testing of the parents to give them the odds of there being problems. That would be better. It would be an improvement. The other possibility would be if it were possible to set things up so the insurance company knew whether or not the customer had been genetically tested. And that's going to be very hard to do in a multi-country world because he can go get genetically tested somewhere outside of our system. But if you imagine a situation where the legal authorities had enough control, as it were, so that they knew who had been tested, then the insurance company could say, well, look, we've got two deals for you. Deal one is if you haven't been tested, we will insure you at a rate representing the average customer. If you have been tested, we'd like to see the test results, thank you, and we'll then set a price based on that. And that would be very hard to enforce, but it's interesting, it would have the virtue that you could buy your insurance and then get tested, and thus get the other advantages of the testing, if you consider them advantages of knowing, you know, should you, yep.
Well, let's say another solution would be exactly what you talked about earlier, what Obama's plan is doing, which is make everyone buy insurance.
Yes, sure. But that then has a lot of other problems, because there are lots of reasons why some people aren't going to want to buy insurance, aside from special knowledge. People will vary on how risk averse they are. They will vary on how much they need the money for other purposes. You can think of a lot of reasons why, not that that isn't a solution, but that's a solution which has costs as well, essentially. All right, so that covered the sort of preliminary stuff before we get to the chapter that you read for this time. Any questions on any of that? All right. Let's talk about contracts then. And the book points out correctly that a large part of your job as lawyers is, in fact, contracts, drawing up contracts, litigating over contracts, and so forth. And that contracts are important more or less across the legal regime. They're important in employment, in partnerships, in sales, contracts between firms, prenuptial agreements, divorce settlements, all of that. I like to complain about how many years it took me to persuade my present wife of the virtues of long-term contracting. But she did eventually give in. Fortunately for both of us, as it turned out. All right. It's a nice example of another point which is implicit throughout this, which is that one side gaining doesn't mean another side loses. That we are both, I'm convinced, and I think she's convinced, we are both substantially better off than if we had never met. And that's, in a sense, what contracts are supposed to be about, making both parties better off. So the question then is, why do you have contracts at all? Why do you have to deal with other people? And the short answer is what economists call gains to trade, that there are circumstances in which a transaction can create a net gain. One reason is that property may be worth different amounts to different people. Another reason is that people have different abilities for producing stuff. So if I hire somebody who is really good at, if I hire someone who's really good at cooking to do my cooking for me by going to a restaurant, I may get a better meal than if I did it myself. Notice, by the way, that even if I'm as good a cook as the cook at the restaurant, if I'm much better at some other things, there's still a gain from trade, because while I could make the same dinner in an hour that he can make, the value of my hour is more than his hour because there's something else I can do, let us imagine, which pays much more than that. And therefore, in monetary terms, the cost to me of an hour is higher than the price he's willing to accept for his hour to cook me dinner, which is what's called the principle of comparative advantage in economics, which is one of these terms that sounds self-explanatory and isn't. But it explains why three-quarters of the talk about competitiveness is nonsense, is economic ignorance. It isn't the case that the U.S. being bad at producing stuff results in our having a trade deficit. U.S. being bad at producing stuff results in our being poor. We're poorer than if we're good at producing stuff. But in the trading, always depends on relative productivities. If we get bad at, if it used to be that we could trade wheat from for cars, because the Japanese were relatively better at cars compared to how good they were at wheat than we were. If we double all our costs, we can still trade wheat for cars. Because the ratio of the price of wheat to the price of cars, not of the price of wheat in the U.S. to the price in Japan. After all, price of wheat in the U.S. is dollars, in Japan is yen. And it's how productive we are that's going to ultimately determine the exchange rate between those two things. Anyway, that's a digression, but it's an important digression. I like to argue that most public discussions of trade policy are rather as if we discussed the space program in terms of Ptolemaic astronomy. I don't know if you're familiar with Ptolemaic astronomy. Ptolemy was the great astronomical source of classical antiquity. And he described a universe with the Earth at the center, surrounded by nested crystal spheres. Crystal, because you could see through them. Which had embedded in them the moon, the sun, the planets, the stars, and so forth. And that's explained why we saw all this stuff turning around us. All right. The economic theory in which a large fraction of public discussions of trade issues is done became obsolete only a century or two after Ptolemaic astronomy did. It's what's called mercantilism, absolute advantage, and it was completely demolished at the beginning of the 19th century by Ricardo, having been heavily criticized before that. And that's this whole stuff about saying the reason we have a trade deficit is that we're bad at producing. And it's not a left-right issue, right? The left says we're bad at producing because we don't have enough government spending on education. And the right says we're bad at reducing because we have too much government regulation. Now, it might be that they are both right about the desirability of their policies, or both wrong, but none of that has anything to do with the trade deficit. Because, anyway, that would be another long discussion which goes beyond this, but I thought I ought to mention it. But in any case, specialization and division of labor, the fact that somebody who does something a whole lot is likely to be better at it than somebody who does it occasionally, complementary abilities, the fact that sometimes what we want to do requires both my skills and your skills, so make a contract we can do better than working by ourselves, and risk sharing, which we've discussed. Now, there's one case which is mentioned very briefly in the book, but not discussed, but which seems to me to raise interesting issues, maybe even philosophical issues. And that's the question, they don't put it this way, are there gains to trade in a bet? Let us suppose that, I don't know the names of football teams, but suppose I believe football team A is going to win the game, and you believe football team B is. And so we agree to bet $10 on the outcome of the game. And I say, well, that bet is profitable to me, because the odds are at least 2-1 that they're going to win, and therefore I'm getting a 2/3 chance of winning $10 at the cost of a 1/3 chance of losing. And you say, well, that bet is profitable to me, because the odds are 2-1 that your team is going to lose, and therefore, similarly. All right. So if you judge values by what we're willing to do, by the bets we're willing to make, we both gain. Excellent. And yet we can't both be right. Right? And they gave the case of speculation in the book on commodity prices and such. And that's a little more complicated because it turns out the speculators do actually produce some useful stuff in the process of betting. But nonetheless, the underlying point of do we count values as we normally do in economics by revealed preference, what you're willing to pay for something, or do we say, no, there is some actual probability out there that we disagree about, and therefore one of us is making a mistake. Anyway. Next question is, why are contracts as elaborate as they are? After all, you could get a lot of what you're describing is with spot sale. The product is more something more useful, valuable to me than you, I'll buy it from you. Even a spot sale, there are going to be dimensions to the contract in terms of what quality of the good you're providing and so forth, when you say you'll deliver it, but often we're dealing with things where performance of our agreement occurs over time, and if it occurs over time, it's then more complicated than just a single transaction. All of that stuff is pretty obvious, but I thought I'd run through it anyway. If you think about objectives in negotiating a contract, there are really two objectives, simplest level. One of the objectives is to maximize the size of the pie, and the other objective is to maximize the relative size of your slice of the pie. The second one was really already discussed, not very extensively, in the previous chapter on game theory, because that's really bilateral monopoly bargaining. And we've talked a bit about commitment strategies and misleading people about the value of something to you. Those are all part of what you do in bilateral monopoly bargaining. And there is the cost that if you do it wrong, you may end up throwing the pie in the trash because of the fact that you don't reach an agreement because each guy is doing too good a job, as it were, of pushing the price in his direction, and they end up with no possibility of agreement. So that's not what this chapter is about. What this chapter is really pretty much entirely about is maximizing the size of the pie. And the basic argument that underlies the chapter, which we ought to discuss and people don't think it's clear that it's right, is that you want to design contracts not looking initially at your share of the pie, but looking at the total pie. You want to design the contract to maximize the total value that the two of you between get by performing the contract. And why do you do that? Because any change in the contract which increases the size of the pie, you can propose to combine with a change in price such that you get some of the benefit, he gets some of the benefit. And any change that increases the size of the pie by reducing the contract, the same thing is true. All right, that's the basic underlying argument. And then really the rest of the chapter, I would argue, is about how to do it. Is about how you would design a contract to maximize the size of the pie. And it's important to think of it that way because the natural way for all of us to think about all these questions, how do I maximize my benefit? And if you forget that if you alter the contract in a way that makes you $10,000 and costs him $20,000, you're probably going to end up worse off when the dust is cleared because he's got to agree to the contract after all and he won't agree to it unless he's gotten compensated in some way for that change. Make sense? Doesn't make sense. So would people like to discuss, before we go on to how to do it, to discuss whatever reservations they have on the general thesis that what you're trying to do is maximize the size of the pie?
Yeah. Alright.
Either you're convinced or you're shy. Let me talk a bit about incentives, because that's another one of these terms that gets misused a lot, and about why incentives matter. And a lot of sort of casual talk seems to imply that more incentives are always good. And that isn't true. And my favorite sort of counterexample is due to Gordon Tullock, who's an economist of the generation before mine, who was a colleague of mine for a while, and who's a very smart, crazy, interesting guy. And Tullock proposed a simple solution to driving accidents problem. It's a nice, low-tech, inexpensive solution. And it consists of requiring every car to have a dagger attached to the center of the steering wheel pointed out. And he argued, I am sure correctly, that if you enforce this rule, there would be many fewer traffic accidents. All right? Because you will drive much more carefully if you know that any time you stop suddenly, you die. And at some point, I think it was Tullock also suggested a high-tech version of the same idea. This was a high-tech one, but it was using off-the-shelf hardware. This one, we have the system that's currently used to fire airbags to detect crashes, but we replaced the airbag with a hand grenade, which is a less expensive thing to build than an airbag. And again, he argued, I think correctly, that you would greatly reduce the death rate from accidents if you did that. And what's nice about both of those is they are making the point that what you want is not an incentive, but the right incentive. That both of those would give you too much incentive. They're also both costly, because when they do actually operate, they kill something. But he's arguing it's going to happen very rarely. So the main effect is they make people drive too carefully. Right. What's the very most, very carefulest way you can drive?
Not drive.
Right. That's zero chance of being an auto accident. Stay out of the car entirely. If the punishment for being an auto accident is high enough, people stop driving. And yet most of us believe that on net, driving is worth its costs much of the time. And that therefore that much of an incentive would result, going back to our earlier discussion, in taking precautions not worth taking. Right, in giving up $1,000 worth of convenience for $100 worth of safety. And that point generalizes because what you really want is not more incentive, but the right incentive. All right. Similarly, if you want to increase the measured GNP of the U.S., one way you could almost certainly do it is to revise our tax system so that marginal tax rates are negative. What do I mean by that? I mean that everybody pays a tax of $10,000 a year minus 5% of his income. In other words, the more money you make, the less taxes you make. All right? You can imagine more extremes. In other words, the problem with that one is we won't have an initial $10,000. I'm going to wave those away because the point I really want to make is that the result of that would be too much of an incentive to work. Because it would mean that even if you value your leisure at $100 and you're only being offered $98 to work, you'll do it because you're getting an extra roughly $5 from the government for working. That makes you worse off, not better off. All right? So what that example hopefully shows, suggests, is that what you really want is the incentive such that the value to you of doing something is equal to the actual value of having it done, such that your benefit equals the, as it were, total social benefit. And in the case of contracts, social benefit is a rather small society, namely it's the contracting parties. So you would like to design your contract in such a way, so far as you can, that each party has an incentive to do those things that, in terms of the effects on the two parties, are on net worth doing, not the ones that are young.
Would you be able to comment on how incentive-sensitive people are? People are not sensitive to the direct incentives, and they give way to other desires, other feelings, irrational, irrational desires and irrational feelings.
There are really two halves to that question. One of them is how sensitive are rational people to incentives? Because after all, if doing something gives me a $1,000 benefit, a $500 tax won't stop me doing it. All right. So one of the questions is how elastic is the supply of what you're looking at in the economist's jargon? To what extent is so? Let's take a real-world case, which is issues over intellectual property rights. Some people would argue that you don't really need copyright at all on the grounds that authors want to write. Right? There are, in fact, lots of novels that are written and not published, or lots of novels that are written and put up on the web, not published for money. Some significant fraction of people don't expect to get paid for writing. People who really enjoy writing a novel, they hope some people will read it, and it would be nice if they got paid. Now, of course, one of the problems with not having copyright or having any other ways of paying authors is that even if they want to, they've also got to earn a living somehow, so you don't have a way in which people who are best at writing novels can spend all their time writing novels. But nonetheless, it is a real question how elastic the supply of novels is with regard to reward. And one could pretty plausibly make an argument saying you really don't need this, there will be almost as many good novels without. And similarly for lots of other things, right? So that's one issue. You're raising a different one. You're raising the question of are people rational? And I guess the answer is that I have a professional commitment to assume they are, because that's sort of the, I would say, the defining assumption of economics, and I'm an economist. And then the question is it a sensible assumption? And my view, at least, is that it is a sensible assumption, but not a true one. It is sensible in the sense that human beings are in part rational, and that the rational part of the behavior is the part we can best predict. So it's true that you might be somebody who, even when we tax something you're doing, you ignore that because you're a very short-sighted person and you just didn't pay attention to what the tax was. You might very easily be a person who, when we change legal rules, is not affected by those incentives. You don't know what the legal rule is. But your ignorance is hard to predict. Your irrational behavior is hard to predict. On the other hand, it's true of pretty much everybody, as far as I can tell, that on average, when something they want to do gets more costly, they do less of it. When it gets more rewarding, they do more of it. So the rational assumption gives you some way of understanding at least the sort of pattern or the predictable part of human behavior. Now, there's an area which has gotten a good deal of attention in recent years called behavioral economics, which attempts to go beyond that, which attempts to say there are certain patterns of irrational behavior we observe and those we can't predict. And if you're curious enough, I had a blog post, somebody else had a set up a sort of exchange on the subject of behavioral economics, so my views on it, which are somewhat mixed, are up on the web. If you wanted to do a search for my name, behavioral economics, you could probably find them. But it's an interesting area. I don't think it's going to replace the rational assumption. It may help, you know, fill in some blanks or fine-tune things or whatever. Because part of the problem is that behavioral economists don't really have any good theory as to why people are irrational in certain ways. That makes it hard to get a solid theory out of it. You can always say, well, there's evidence against it. We'll just change our description of their irrationality. But no, I would agree that rational behavior is not a perfect description of human behavior, but I think it may be a better description than people. Let me give you sort of my favorite example. It doesn't really prove anything, but I think it's still indicative. And that is that one of the versions of irrationality that a lot of people believe in other people is the sort of death or glory view that maybe modern middle-class Americans are people who calculate risks and so forth, but there have been lots of other societies where people said, well, you know, I don't care. If I live or die, I'm just going to be a hero. And let me tell you, would you rather have this story in verse or in prose? Because I have both versions of it. This is the story from one of the Icelandic sagas.
I prefer prose.
Prose. All right. There was the Earl of the Orkney Islands organized a Viking army to try to conquer Ireland. And the Jarl had a battle banner, raven banner. And the people, he and the people in his army believed that there was a magic spell on this banner. And the magic spell was that as long as the banner flew over the army would advance. But whoever carried the banner would die. Right? And they, fighting the Battle of Clontarf, which was a battle between this Norse army with some Irish allies and the High King of Ireland, his army. And the Jarl's army is advancing, and the man carrying the banner dies. And someone else picks up the banner, and the army advances further, and the banner carrier dies. And the Jarl turns to one of the men around and says, you know, pick up, take the banner. And the guy steps forward, and his buddy next to him says, don't touch that thing, it's death. The guy comes back. Jarl can't find the third man to carry the banner. So he says, it is fitting the beggar should bear the bag. Cuts the banner off the staff, wraps it around his own waist so that he can carry it while fighting, and leads his army forward. He dies, and nobody takes the banner off his body. So here you've got an army of Viking warriors, sort of the according to our literature, the sort of prototypical, heroic, irrational, blood and glory types. And in the whole army, only three men, including the Jarl, are willing to buy victory at the price of their own deaths. So I think it's sort of an interesting point that I think may overestimate how irrational other people are. Not that nobody else, obviously, is irrational, but in a sense, if you look at sort of suicide bombers, that's a very small part of the population, right? And if you act in a spectacularly irrational fashion, it's going to be noticeable, and therefore you may overestimate how much of that there is. But another story, actually, which is the true story that actually happened to me, and this is an economic story, I suppose, and that is, it used to be the case that dollar bills were silver certificates. And the silver certificate you could take in and have redeemed for a certain amount of silver. And over time, the price of silver rose and started approaching the point at which it would pay you to turn your silver certificates into silver. The silver certificate was worth almost a dollar at that time. And of course, but by that time, only a minority of dollar bills were silver, or $5 bills were silver certificates. Most of them were Federal Reserve notes, which had no such guarantee. And at the point when the price of silver is at almost a dollar for a dollar's worth, for silver you get for a dollar, a silver certificate is really worth more than a dollar because it's a free gamble. If the price of silver goes down, it's still worth a dollar. If it goes up, it's worth more than a dollar. And I mentioned this to a friend of mine and commented that the result of this was that silver certificates vanished from circulation. Something called Gresham's Law as it happens. And at the time, I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. And I was living in what at the time was the edge of the black South Side ghetto, which is adjacent to the University of Chicago in an apartment. And my roommate, I think, whom I mentioned, they said, well, you know, that's fine for you. You know, you're interested in economics. And most people don't know anything about this stuff. So therefore, it's not going to happen. They're not going to vanish. And I think, like, within a few days, I go down to the neighborhood corner grocery store. And I'm buying my groceries. And the lady at the checkout counter looks at the money I paid and says, you don't want to pay with that. That's a silver certificate. Handed that to me, and I put it in my pocket and paid with a Federal Reserve note. And that was sort of a neat story about how much better informed ordinary people are likely to be about things that matter, which in this case didn't. She was a nice person. She could have just taken it, traded it for a Fed note of her own. But that was a neat story. But anyway, So I think all of that is relevant to your question. I'm certainly not arguing that it's a perfect description, but only that it's a useful description. There's enough truth to it to be of use. So let's go back to what we were talking about, which are contracts, and in particular to a fixed price contract for building a house, and think about the case, which I think somewhere in the chapter, part you've read or not, they discuss where the question is what kind of roofing material the builder uses. And you can imagine that he's got a choice between $10,000 roofing material that will last for 20 years or $5,000 material that lasts for 5 years and will then cost $12,000 to replace. Okay, let me put up those numbers.
$5,000 plus $12,000. That's what it's going to cost you after 5 years to get the next, to get the remaining 15 years by comparing it.
And if you have a fixed cost contract and nothing in the contract specifying the quality of the roofing material, the builder, rational fellow that he is going to go with the $5,000 material. And the question is, why is that a bad thing? And the answer to this chapter is, it's a bad thing because it's changing a net cost of $10,000 into a net cost of $17,000. Strictly speaking, a little bit less because the $12,000 is 5 years later, and we ought to discount for interest rates and stuff. I'm going to ignore all of that. But then the question is, well, why won't he do it anyway? And the answer is, because I am going to say to him in advance, we insist on your using the good material. And if you aren't willing to sign that contract, I'm going to pay you enough less to make up for the fact that I'm going to be paying this cost. All right? So that the problem here is not that he's used low-quality material, but that he's used inefficiently low-quality material. He used low-quality material where the savings in money was less than the cost of money. And you could imagine changing the numbers. Suppose I turned this $12,000 into $2,000. Now we would like him to use the low-quality material. Now the low-quality material really is less. So the problem is we want to give them incentives that will result in using the high quality in the $12,000 and the low quality in the $2,000. Right, that's again a point about the general issue of giving people the right incentives. Okay. Similarly, with regard to breach of contracts, that it's tempting to say we should always keep your contracts, but that's clearly the wrong answer. Because you can imagine contracts that ought to be breached. There's some famous case, which I forget the name of, not being a lawyer, I don't have to memorize cases, but it was a case where somebody contracted to have some land cleared, and the contract was signed somewhere around 1928 or so. And by the time it was time for the land to be cleared, the stock market crash had occurred, the economy was sliding downhill, and it was pretty clear that the value of the land after it was cleared was going to be less than the cost of clearing it. And so the guy attempted to back out of the contract. I don't remember what happened anymore. Maybe some of you know the case and can tell me. But the point I'm making is that a regime in which he has to go ahead with the contract and I have to pay him the cost of clearing the land would result in an undesirable outcome because it would result in doing something that wasn't worth doing. So you would therefore like rules for breach which have the characteristic that they prevent breach when the breach is inefficient, meaning when the breach results in a net loss for the two parties, but permit breach when the breach results in a net gain for the two parties. And the standard idea of how to do this is that you have what are called expectation damages, which say that when I breach the contract, I've got to pay you damages that make you as well off as if I fulfilled the contract. Now, since you've been fully compensated, if it's worth my doing that, then that means that there was, in fact, a net gain for breach. Right? After compensating you, I'm still better off breaching than we had a net gain for breach. Further point, which the book discusses, and which I will mention probably because I've got another good story, is the issue of enforceability and observability. That if specifying you must use a good grade of roofing material only works if, A, we have a way of knowing what grade you used. You can imagine a case where the roofing material is underneath the tiles or something, and I'm not going to get to inspect the thing until after the whole thing is done. It'll be very costly to tear up tires to see the tiles and see what you used. Maybe roofing isn't a good example, but you can certainly think of cases where it's hard to know whether or not you've kept the terms of the contract and whether or not we can enforce it. For example, it's got to be good roofing material. How easily can we prove to a court what is or isn't good roofing material? And my favorite story here is a medieval Islamic story. It's one of my two medieval Islamic law and economics stories from, I think, Al-Tanuki, who was a judge in Baghdad around the 10th century or so. And he tells the story that a certain vizier was going about the countryside taking petitions and giving alms and dealing with things that had to be dealt with. And he received a petition for alms from a poor woman. And he wrote down, pay this woman 200 dinar. And he gave her the writing to take to his treasurer. And the treasurer was astonished at his master giving so large a sum in alms to a woman. And so he went back to the vizier and said, did you really write this? And the vizier said, well, it was my intention to write, pay this woman 200 dinar. But since it was the will of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, that my hand slipped and I wrote dinar instead of dirham, gold instead of silver, pay it out of Israel. And so was committed, and so was done. And 3 days later, a poor man came to the vizier with a petition. And the poor man's petition said that 3 days before, the vizier had given his wife 200 dinar. And she had now decided that she was too wealthy a woman to be married to a poor old man like him, and was threatening to force her husband to divorce her. And so the man asked the vizier to appoint somebody in authority to prevent his wife from making him divorce her. And the vizier thought a moment, took out paper and pen, and wrote, pay this man 200 dinar. People see the point of the story? Under Islamic law, how can a wife make a man make her husband divorce her? This is relevant. Some of you might want to make your husbands or wives divorce you on some future occasion. How do you do it? Is it obvious? Nobody? Suppose you're in a marriage that you want to get out of. You've just fallen in love with a younger and more beautiful woman. And you're in a legal system which only allows divorce by mutual agreement. And you're not wealthy enough to bribe your wife. What do you do? If you're a woman, you're not wealthy enough to bribe your husband. You can do either version of the story.
Isn't it obvious?
Yep.
Just you come forward. So she's better off.
Well, yeah, that's pretty costly to you, too. What nice people you are. You do a really bad job of being a husband. You know, you wake her up 4 times during the night, saying that you're, you know, will she get you something to drink? And you complain about her cooking. And if it's legal, you beat her. And if it's illegal to beat her, you find other ways. You yell at her. And, you know, you don't do anything she wants. And you insist on living in a place where that you like and she doesn't like. You think about marriage arrangement. There are all sorts of ways you can be a really bad husband or a really bad wife. And since Islamic law doesn't let the wife divorce her husband, I think it's pretty clear that part of the point of this story is that what she was really threatening to do was to nag and to serve him food that tasted horrible and to complain about it to all the neighbors, to do whatever things she could do in that society that would make being married to her worse than that. And of course, the point of the punchline is that the vizier, who's much richer and more powerful than these people, doesn't see any way of stopping it, and therefore instead gives the husband money so that she won't want to. All right, that's in a sense the point, I think, of Al-Tanuki's story. And it's sort of a neat story about the problem of enforceability in this, because one of the real problems with the marriage contract is that most of the relevant terms aren't observable by third parties and therefore aren't enforceable. And that raises real issues, which we'll get back to later. You might want to think about it, because it's an important real-world issue as well as an intellectually interesting one, about how you design marriage contracts, given that problem. that the traditional solution, at least in our society, is you make divorce very hard and you have the duties of the two parties largely fixed by social custom. So that you can say, if he isn't supporting her, A, that may be grounds for divorce, and B, everyone will think very badly of him. Depending on the particular stratum you're in, if she doesn't keep the house clean and the kids reasonably well behaved, everybody will think badly of her. Probably isn't the grounds for divorce, but there'll be at least social pressure on her. So that's a case where you don't have any real bargaining over the terms of the marriage, and where you've got sufficiently sharply defined terms that the society can enforce it. Not perfectly, but the current system is basically one in which you have divorce on demand, and the terms of the marriage are freely negotiable day by day. And there are obviously potential problems with that as well. And I will let you think about what the problems are, who does or doesn't get hurt when you make divorce or easier or harder. We'll probably come back to that at some point. Interesting. But in any case, what that suggests is that ideally, if the contract involves specifying terms of performance, they are terms that are observable and enforceable, so that whatever mechanism you're using to enforce it can tell whether or not the roofing, you specified the roofing must be brand X, their quality B roofing, and we can tell whether or not that was done. And the further enforceability problem in some cases is, if enforceability is by damage payments, what if the party who doesn't keep the contract is judgment proof, doesn't have the assets to pay the damage? So that's going to be another potential problem. Right. Now, a further issue, which we'll get to more in a few days, but we just mentioned and then passed off in the book at this point, is mechanisms for enforcing other than the courts, and in particular reputational. They're discussing both reputational and ethical constraints. I understand reputation better of the two, so we'll talk more about that. But that you can see that one reason why people keep their contracts is either they want to do business with you in the future, and even if you can't prove to a court that they cheated on the contract, you know they cheated on the contract. And again, if you think about how marriages work, a good deal of what marriages work is that people know that if you acted badly towards your wife yesterday, you know, she may not make your favorite dish for dinner tomorrow. Further examples can be gathered if you wanted to. In addition, of course, in other contexts than that one, reputation matters for other people. That if the home builder has the reputation, well, yes, he won't do anything that he'll lose in court on, but he cuts every corner he can get away with, he may find it hard to get customers in the future for building houses. And we'll get into some of that more later. So let's run into the case of building a house, a production contract, which is what they discuss at some length. And the simple way of looking at it is just in terms of the distinction between a cost plus and a flat fee, because obviously you've got lots of things in between, but that's a nice neat way of thinking about it. And what's the advantage of the flat fee? What are the two advantages of the flat fee contract from the standpoint? Advantages I now mean in terms of the total size of the pie, not in terms of one party or the other. And what's good about a flat fee contract?
Ready? Yeah. The builder has an incentive to obtain those costs that are not passed off to the tenant.
He has an incentive to hold down costs. And notice that the costs he's holding down, in a sense, are better than the ones you could monitor, even if you had perfect monitoring of what he was doing. Because you don't always want him to use the least. Imagine that the identical roofing could be available for $10,000 or for $9,000. But in order to get it at $9,000, he's got to spend weeks of time checking to see if anybody's got a surplus of that roofing they're trying to get rid of, etc. Well, if those weeks of time are more than $1,000 worth of his time, you don't want him to get a cheaper one. And yet, if you had a legal rule which said he's got to use the cheapest, you'd be trying to force him to do it. So the nice thing from that point about the flat rate contract is that it gives him an incentive to minimize all costs, including both the measurable financial costs and the unmeasurable costs of his own time and effort. Makes sense? Right. So that's an attractive feature of that. And what's the downside of that, obviously, which discussed already in the book. What's the problem with getting to minimize all costs?
Yep. The lowest quality.
That's right. He has an incentive to minimize cost, even if doing so is inefficient, because it's providing a non-monetary cost, not to him, but to you, in the form of a lower quality product. So that would suggest that you might want to use the flat fee contract in cases where quality was easily measurable. For arguably, at least, a flat fee contract is the simplest way to have your lawn cut, because when it's over, you can look out and see whether he cut the lawn. And you're probably going to hire him to cut the lawn every week, so if he not only cut the lawn, but also cut some of your roses, you'll fire him and hire someone else, so he's got an incentive to maintain. But anyway, so then the alternative is the cost-plus arrangement, and obviously that's got the flip side of that, the cost plus. If he succeeds by spending a little time and effort in getting something cheaper, then the result is a saving to you, not to him. So why should you decide for reputational and similar incentives? And arguably, the cost plus 10%, which some of the cost pluses are, is even worse than that. So now he makes more money if he uses either a higher than desirable quality or a more expensive version of the same. Why do you think cost could be cost plus 10% rather than cost plus $10,000? Why might it plausibly? Why would you observe some contracts of that form? Sounds sort of perverse, like you're paying him to make it more expensive. But why might you choose to do that? Yep.
Because you can easily compare the bidding process then with other vendors?
Well, you could make it cost plus X thousand dollars and compare it too. Think about it as a risk aversion problem for a moment. Suppose, because the other difference, of course, is that the fixed price contract puts all the risk on the contractor, whereas the cost plus contract puts all the risk on the buyer. Suppose you wanted to put all the risk on the buyer. Suppose for whatever reason you believe the buyer is not risk averse, that it's true he's having a house built, but this is his ninth house, he's a billionaire, and so risk aversion is not a big issue for a mere $500,000 house. Trivia. And so if you had cost plus $5,000, what risk still remains with the contractor? What risk on him? We're talking about risk sharing, not other problems. Yep.
How long it takes to build.
That's right. How much of his time and effort the isn't going into. In which you're not reimbursing him for. You're reimbursing him a fixed price for his time and effort. And now he's got the problem that if it turns out that the house takes twice as long to build because there's a strike and this problem, but this problem, it's going to cost him more. So one argument, one possible explanation why you're doing that cost plus 10% is that it's an approximate way of making it a measure of his non-measurable costs, his time and effort, are going to roughly scale with. So that would be a possible reason. This gets me into another digression, which some of you might find useful, and that's Friedman's rule for finding the men's room. And all of you might find it useful because with appropriate changes, it works for finding the ladies' room, too. And Friedman's rule for finding the men's room is that the men's room is adjacent in one of the three dimensions to the ladies' room. And, of course, that works in the other directions. Well, why is this the case? This is the case because of economies of scale in plumbing stacks. The plumbing stack is the bunch of pipes that you need to have a restroom. And it is cheaper to have one plumbing stack that will handle two restrooms than to have two that will handle one. And consequently, almost always, there are exceptions, but almost always you will observe that in buildings they put them next to each other. Sometimes one above the other, sometimes next to each other. And there are two exceptions that I know of to Friedman's law. One of the exceptions is the lowest floor, especially the basement of a building, because there the plumbing stacks running horizontally, and therefore you can have things separated. And the other exception is buildings built on government contract for cost plus 10%. But those are the basic points of that argument. Again, we don't want the highest quality inputs. We want the right quality inputs. It's the same issue as before. We don't always eat it. Gourmet restaurants, and with the flat fee contract, the builder's incentive is to use the least expensive goods, and therefore you need some mechanisms such as specifying in places where you think there's a real problem what the quality of the good is going to be. And if the cost plus fixed amount, he doesn't care. And if the cost plus 10%, he has a mild incentive to use things that are too good. All right, another issue is going to be uncertainty. And uncertainty is partly the problem I mentioned of renegotiating the contract. And there, as I said, part of the problem is that you're in a bilateral monopoly. And I should say, going back for a moment to marriages, that one of the striking points of marriage and to a lesser extent of employment contract is that you have a competitive market going in and a bilateral monopoly going out. That is to say, each of us would like to believe, of course, that the person you fell in love with was the only possible person. But were that true, there would be essentially almost no successful marriages unless God took a hand and made sure that out of all the people in the world, you happened to meet the right one. I actually once did some rough calculations, and I think I concluded that my wife is about a 1 in 100,000 catch. That still means there are quite a lot of other people out there who would have been as well suited. But the point is that once you're married, now you can't possibly substitute one of the other people because you've got a house in common, you've got friends in common, you may have children in common, you have both spent a lot of time and effort learning how to live with the other person, which can be a really hard thing to learn. One of the things that makes my wife such a rare catch is she's willing to put up with me, which not all women, or even not very many women, would be willing to do. And so once you've made all those investments, now you're stuck in a big bilateral monopoly bargain when you're considering either changing the terms in any of lots of ways, such as where do we live, for example, or getting out of it. And the same thing really is true about employment contracts, that most jobs you've got what are sometimes referred to as by economists as relationship-specific sunk costs, meaning that having taken the position that when I'm offered a position by Santa Clara, I would be just as happy with a position with any of 20 other equally good law schools, or maybe some economics departments too. But once I'm here, I've got a house, I've got friends, I have found my way around the department, I know sort of how to do things here, and so I'm in something closer to a bilateral monopoly bargain than I was going in. And it's true on the other side, too, that from their standpoint, if they got somebody new, they'd have to teach him various things that I know, and so forth. So one of the problems associated with both marriage and employment law is that you have to, part of the reason why you like to specify stuff in advance in some form is because in advance you're on a competitive market, and once the contract is been executed, started being executed, you're now in a bilateral monopoly. All right? I think that covers more or less what I wanted to say. So I believe if you check the syllabus that there are some things that we're going to, there's some problems that you do not have to hand in but are supposed to think about so we can discuss for next time.
Right.
Thank you. My voice at least made it so far. I don't guarantee for this evening, but I hope.